You told me. Last night. You told me stress could trigger a flashback. So that's what happened. That thing went for your buddy, you jumped for the switch, shut that table down. He fell over, cut his head. I was taking care of that when I noticed you were funny. Figured out you only had consecutive memory for about 5 minutes at a stretch. Get that in shock cases sometimes, or concussion.
Where is he? Gentry.
He's in bed up in his place, plastered with downs. The shape he was in, I figured he could do with about a day's sleep. Anyway, it gets him out of our hair for a while.
Slick closed his eyes and saw the gray thing again. The thing that had gone for Gentry. Man-shaped, sort of. Or like an ape. Nothing like the convoluted shapes Gentry's equipment generated in his search for the shape.
I think the power's out, Cherry said. The light went out in here about 6 hours ago.
He opened his eyes.
The cold.
Gentry hadn't made his moves on the console. He groaned. He left Cherry to make coffee on the butane cooker and went looking for Little Bird. He found him by the smell of smoke. Little Bird had built a fire in a steel canister and gone to sleep curled around it like a dog.
Hey, Slick said, nudging the boy with his boot. Get up. We got problems.
Fucking juices out,
he mumbled. Sitting up in a greasy nylon sleeping bag, grimed the exact shade of factory's floor.
I noticed. That's problem number one. Number two is we need a truck or a hover or something.
We have to get that guy out of here.
It's not working out with Gentry.
But Gentry's the only one can fix the juice.
Little Bird got to his feet, shivering.
Gentry's sleeping. Who's got a truck?
Marvy and them,
Little Bird said, and lapsed into a racking cough.
Take Gentry's bike. Bring it back in the truck. Now!
Little Bird recovered from his coughing fit.
No shit.
You know how to ride it, don't you?
Yeah, but Gentry, he'll get...
You let me worry about that. You know where he keeps that spare key?
Yeah,
Little Bird said shyly.
Say,
he ventured.
What if Marvy and them don't want to give me that truck?
Give him this, Slick said,
pulling the Ziploc full of drugs from the pocket of his jacket. Cherry had taken it after she'd bandaged Gentry's head.
And give him all of it, understand? 'Cause I'm gonna ask him later.
Cherry's beeper went off while they were drinking coffee in Slick's room, huddled side by side on the edge of the bed. He'd been telling her as much as he knew about the Korsakovs, because she'd asked him. He hadn't ever really told anybody about it, and it was funny how little he actually knew. He told her about previous flashbacks, then tried to explain how the system worked in jail. The trick was that you retained long-term memory up to the point where they put you on the stuff. That way, they could train you to do something before you started serving your time, and you didn't forget how to do it. Mostly, you did stuff that robots could do. They'd trained him to assemble miniature gear trains. When he'd learned to put one together inside 5 minutes, that was it.
And they didn't do anything else? She asked.
Just those gear trains.
No, I mean like brain locks.
He looked at her. The sore on her lip was almost healed.
If they do that, they don't tell you,
he said. Then the beeper went off in one of her jackets.
Something's wrong,
she said, getting up quickly. They found Gentry kneeling beside the stretcher with something black in his hands. Cherry snatched the thing before Gentry could move. He stayed where he was, blinking up at her.
Takes a lot to keep you under, mister.
She handed Slick the black thing. A retinal camera.
We have to find out,
who he is,
Gentry said. His voice was thick with the downs she'd administered. But Slick sensed that the bad edge of craziness had receded.
Hell, she said, you don't even know if these are the eyes he had a year ago.
Gentry touched the bandage on his temple.
You saw it too, didn't you?
Yeah, Cherry said. He shut it off.
It was the shock, Gentry said. I hadn't imagined. There was no real danger. I wasn't ready.
You were out of your fucking skull, Cherry said.
Gentry got unsteadily to his feet.
He's leaving, Slick said. I sent Bird to borrow a truck. I don't like any of this shit.
Cherry stared at him.
Leaving where? I gotta go with him. It's my job.
I know a place, Slick lied. The power's out, Gentry. You can't take him anywhere, Gentry said. Like hell. No!
Gentry swayed slightly.
He stays. The jumpers are in place. I won't disturb him again. Cherry can stay here.
You're going to have to explain some shit here, Gentry, Slick said.
To begin with,
Gentry said, and pointed at the thing above the Count's head.
This isn't an LF. It's an Aleph.
Chapter 19. Under the Knife. Hotel again. Sinking into the death march of Whiz Crash. Pryor leading her into the lobby. Japanese tourists already up and clustering around bored-looking guides. And one foot after the other. Her head so heavy now, like somebody punched a hole in the top, poured in a quarter kilo of dull lead, and her teeth felt like they belonged to somebody else. Too big. She slumped against the side of the elevator, when its extra gravity pressed down.
Where's Eddie?
Eddie's gone, Mona.
Got her eyes open wide, and she looked at him, seeing the smile was back, bastard.
What?
Eddie's been bought out. Compensated. He's on his way to Macau with a line of credit. Nice little gambling junket.
Compensated?
For his investment. In you. For his time.
His time?
The doors slid open on blue-carpeted corridor, and something falling through her cold. Eddie hated gambling.
You're working for us now, Mona. We wouldn't want you off on your own again.
But you did, she thought.
You let me go. And you knew where to find me.
Eddie's gone.
She didn't remember falling asleep. She was still wearing the dress, Michael's jacket tucked up around her shoulders like a blanket. She could see the corner of the mountainside building without moving her head, but the bighorn wasn't there. The Angie stems were still sealed in plastic. She took one at random, slit the wrapper with a thumbnail, slotted it and put the trodes on. She wasn't thinking. Her hands seemed to know what to do. Friendly animals that wouldn't hurt her. One of them touched play and she slid into the Angie world, pure as any drug. Slow saxophone and limo glide through some European city. How the streets revolved around her, around the driverless car. Broad avenues, dawn clean and almost empty. With the touch of fur against her shoulders, and rolling on down a straight road through flat fields edged with perfect, identical trees. And turning, tires over raked gravel, up a winding drive through parkland where the dew was silver. Here an iron deer, there a wet white marble torso. The house was vast, old, unlike any house she'd seen before. but the car swung past it, then past several smaller buildings, coming at last to the edge of a smooth, broad field. There were gliders tethered there, translucent membrane drawn taut over fragile-looking frames of polycarbon. They quivered slightly in the morning breeze. Robin Lanier was waiting beside them, handsome, easy Robin in a rough black sweater who played opposite Angie in almost all of her stims. And she was leaving the car now, taking to the field, laughing when her heels sank into the grass. And the rest of the way to Robin with her shoes in her hand, grinning into his arms and his smell. His eyes. A whirl, a dance of editing, condensing the business of boarding the glider on the silver induction rail, and they were flung smoothly down the length of the field, lifting now, banking to catch the wind, and up, up, until the great house was an angular pebble in a swath of green, green cut by a dull gleam of curving river. And Pryor's hand on stop. Smell of food from the cart beside the bed knotting her stomach, the dull sick ache of whiz-crash in every joint. 8, he said. We're leaving soon. He took the metal cover from one of the plates. Club sandwich, he said. Coffee, pastries, doctor's orders. Once you're at the clinic, you won't be eating for a while.
Clinic?
Gerald's place. Baltimore.
Why?
Gerald's a cosmetic surgeon. You're having some work done. All of it reversible later, if you want, but we think you'll be pleased with the results. Very pleased. The smile. Anyone ever tell you how much you look like Angie, Mona? She looked up at him, said nothing. Managed to sit up, to drink half a cup of watery black coffee. She couldn't bring herself to look at the sandwich, but she ate one of the pastries. It tasted like cardboard. Baltimore. She wasn't too sure where that was. And somewhere, a glider hung forever above a tame green country, fur against her shoulder. And Angie must still be there. Still laughing. An hour later, in the lobby, while Pryor signed the bill, she saw Eddie's black gator clone suitcases go by on a robot baggage cart, and that was when she knew for sure that he was dead. Gerald's office had a sign with big old-fashioned letters, fourth floor of a condo rack, in what Pryor said was Baltimore. The kind of building where they throw up a framework and commercial tenants bring their own modules, plug-ins. Like a high-rise trailer camp. Everything snaked with bundled cables, optics, lines for sewage and water.
What's it say?
She asked Pryor.
Gerald Chin. Dentist. You said he was a plastic surgeon.
He is.
Why can't we just go to a boutique like everybody else?
He didn't answer. She couldn't really feel much now, and part of her knew that she wasn't as scared as she should be. Maybe that was okay, though, because if she got scared enough, she wouldn't be able to do anything, and definitely she wanted to get out of the whole deal, whatever it was. On the drive over, she discovered this lump in the pocket of Michael's jacket. It had taken her 10 minutes to figure out it was a shock rod, like nervous suits carried. It felt like a screwdriver handle with a pair of blunt metal horns where the shaft should be. It probably charged off wall current. She just hoped Michael had kept up the charge. She figured Pryor didn't know it was there. They were legal, most places, because they weren't supposed to do much permanent damage. But Lynette had known a girl who'd gotten worked over real bad with one and never got much better. If Pryor didn't know it was in her pocket, it meant he didn't know everything. And he had a stake in having her think he did. But then he hadn't known how much Eddie hated gambling. She couldn't feel much about Eddie either, except she still figured he was dead. No matter how much they'd given him, he still wouldn't walk out without those cases. Even if he was going for a whole new wardrobe, he'd need to get all dressed up to go shopping for it. Eddie cared about clothes more than almost anything, and those gator cases were special. He'd got them off a hotel thief in Orlando, and they were the closest thing he had to a home. And anyway, now that she thought about it, she couldn't see him going for a buyout bid, because what he wanted most in the whole world was to be part of some big deal. Once he was, he figured, people would start to take him seriously. So somebody finally took him seriously, she thought, as Pryor carried her back into Gerald's clinic. But not the way Eddie wanted. She looked around at the 20-year-old plastic furniture, the stacks of Stimstar magazines with Jap writing. It looked like a Cleveland haircut place. There was nobody there. Nobody behind the reception desk. Then Gerald came through the white door, wearing the kind of crinkled foil suit that paramedics wore for traffic accidents.
"Lock the door,"
he said to Pryor, through a blue paper mask that hid his nose, mouth, and chin.
"Hello, Mona, if you'll step this way."
He gestured toward the white door. She had her hand around the shock rod now, but she didn't know how to turn it on. She followed Gerald, Pryor taking up the rear.
"Have a seat," Gerald said.
She sat on a white enamel chair. He came close, looked at her eyes.
"You need to rest, Mona. You're exhausted."
There was a serrated stud on the shock rod's handle. "Press it, forward, back." Gerald went to a white box with drawers, got something out.
"Here," he said,
extending a little tube thing with writing on the side.
"This will help you."
She barely felt the tiny measured spray. There was a black blot on the aerosol tube, just where her eyes tried to focus. Growing. She remembered the old man showing her how you kill a catfish. Catfish has a hole in its skull, covered with skin. You take something stiff and skinny, a wire, even a broom straw did it, and you just slip it in. She remembered Cleveland. Ordinary kind of day before it was time to get working, sitting up in Lynette's, looking at a magazine. Found this picture of Angie, laughing in a restaurant with some other people. Everybody pretty, but beyond that, it was like they had this glow. Not really in the photograph, but it was there anyway. Something you feel.
"Look," she said to Lynette, showing her the picture. "They got this glow."
"It's called money," Lynette said.
"It's called money.
You just slip it in." Chapter 20. Hilton Swift. He arrived unannounced, as he always did, and alone, the Ned helicopter settling like a solitary wasp, stirring strands of seaweed across the damp sand. She watched from the rust-eaten railing as he jumped down, something boyish, almost bumbling in his apparent eagerness. He wore a long top coat of brown tweed. Unbuttoned, it showed the immaculate front of one of his candy-striped shirts, the prop wash stirring his brown blonde hair and fluttering his sense net tie. Robin was right, she decided. He did look as though his mother dressed him. Perhaps it was deliberate, she thought, as he came striding up the beach, a feigned naivete. She remembered Porfire once maintaining that major corporations were entirely independent of the human beings who composed the body corporate. This had seemed patently obvious to Angie, but the hairdresser had insisted that she'd failed to grasp his basic premise. Swift was SenseNet's most important human decision-maker. The thought of Porfire made her smile. Swift, taking it as a greeting, beamed back at her. He offered her lunch in San Francisco. The helicopter was extremely fast. she countered by insisting on preparing him a bowl of dehydrated Swiss soup and microwaving a frozen brick of sourdough rye. She wondered, watching him eat, about his sexuality. In his late 30s, he somehow conveyed the sense of an extraordinarily bright teenager in whom the onset of puberty had been subtly delayed. Rumor, at one time or another, had supplied him with every known sexual preference, and with several that she assumed were entirely imaginary. None of them seemed at all likely to Angie. She'd known him since she'd come to SenseNet. He'd been well established in the upper echelons of production when she'd arrived, one of the top people in Tali Isham's team, and he'd taken an immediate professional interest in her. Looking back, she assumed that Legba had steered her into his path. He'd been so obviously on his way up. Though she might not have seen it herself then, dazzled by the glitter and constant movement of the scene. Bobby had taken an instant dislike to him, bristling with a Barrytowner's inbred hostility to authority, but had generally managed to conceal it for the sake of her career. The dislike had been mutual. Swift greeting their split and Bobby's departure with obvious relief. "Hilton," she said, as she poured him a cup of the herbal tea he preferred to coffee. "What is it that's keeping Robin in London?" He looked up from the steaming cup. "Something personal, I think. Perhaps he's found a new friend." Bobby had always been Angie's friend to Hilton. Robin's friends tended to be young, male, and athletic. The muted erotic sequences in her stims with Robin were assembled from stock footage provided by Continuity and heavily treated by Rabel and his effects team. She remembered the one night they'd spent together in a wind-blown house in southern Madagascar, his passivity and his patience. They'd never tried again. And she'd suspected that he feared that intimacy would undermine the illusion their stims projected so perfectly. "What did he think of me going into the clinic, Hilton? Did he tell you?" "I think he admired you for it. Someone told me recently that he's been telling people I'm crazy." He'd rolled up his striped shirt sleeves and loosened his tie. "I can't imagine Robin thinking that, let alone saying it. I know what he thinks of you. You know what gossip is in the net." "Hilton, where's Bobby?" His brown eyes, very still. "Isn't that over, Angie?" "Hilton, you know. You must know. You know where he is. Tell me." "We lost him. Lost him. Security lost him. You're right, of course, we kept the closest possible track of him after he left you. He reverted to type." There was an edge of satisfaction in his voice.
"And what type was that?"
"I've never asked what brought you together," he said. "Security investigated both of you, of course. He was a petty criminal." She laughed.
"He wasn't even that."
"You were unusually well-represented, Angie, for an unknown. You know that your agents made it a key condition of your contract that we take Bobby Newmark on as well."
"Contracts have had stranger conditions, Hilton, and he went on salary as your companion, my friend."
Was Swift actually blushing? He broke eye contact, looked down at his hands. "When he left you, he went to Mexico, Mexico City. Security was tracing him, of course. We don't like to lose track of anyone who knows that much about the personal life of one of our stars. Mexico City is a very complicated place. We do know that he seemed to be trying to continue his previous career."
"He was hustling cyberspace?"
He met her eyes again. "He was seeing people in the business. Known criminals."
"And? Go on."
"He faded out. Vanished.
Do you have any idea what Mexico City is like if you slip below the poverty line? And he was poor. He'd become an addict, according to our best sources.
An addict? Addicted to what?
I don't know. Continuity! He almost spilled his tea. Hello, Angie. Bobby Continuity. Bobby Newmark, my friend. Glaring at Swift. He went to Mexico City. Hilton says he became addicted to something. A drug, Continuity? I'm sorry, Angie. That's classified data. Hilton. Continuity? He began and coughed. Hello, Hilton. Executive override, Continuity. Do we have that information? Security sources describe Newmark's addiction as neuroelectronic.
I don't understand.
Some sort of a wirehead business. Swift offered. She felt an impulse to tell him how she'd found the drug. The charger.
Hush, child.
Her head was full of the sound of bees, of building pressure. Angie, what is it? He was up from his chair, reaching for her.
Nothing, I'm upset. I'm sorry. Nerves.
It isn't your fault. I was going to tell you about finding Bobby's cyberspace deck. But you already know about that, don't you? Can I get you anything? Water?
No, thanks, but I'll lie down for a while if you don't mind. But stay, please. I have some ideas for orbital sequences that I'd like your advice on.
Of course. Have a nap. I'll have a walk on the beach, and then we'll talk. She watched him from the bedroom window, watched his brown figure recede in the direction of the colony, followed by the patient little Dornier. He looked like a child on the empty beach. He looked as lost as she felt. Chapter 21 The Aleph. As the sun rose, still no power for the 100-watt bulbs, Gentry's loft filled with a new light. Winter sunlight softened the outlines of the consoles and the hollow table, brought out the texture of the ancient books that lined sagging chipboard shelves along the west wall. As Gentry paced and talked, his blonde rooster tail bobbing each time he spun on a black boot heel, his excitement seemed to counter the lingering effects of Cherry's sleep derms. Cherry sat on the edge of the bed, watching Gentry but glancing occasionally at the battery telltale on the stretcher's superstructure. Slick sat in a broken-down chair scrounged from the solitude and recushioned with transparent plastic over wadded pads of discarded clothing. To Slick's relief, Gentry had skipped the whole business of the shape and launched straight into his theory about the Aleph thing. As always, once Gentry got going, he used words and constructions that Slick had trouble understanding. But Slick knew from experience that it was easier not to interrupt him. The trick was in pulling some kind of meaning out of the overall flow, skipping over the parts you didn't understand. Gentry said that the count was jacked into what amounted to a mother-huge Microsoft. He thought the slab was a single solid lump of biochip. If that was true, the thing's storage capacity was virtually infinite. It would have been unthinkably expensive to manufacture. It was, Gentry said, a fairly strange thing for anyone to have built at all, although such things were rumored to exist and to have their uses, most particularly in the storage of vast amounts of confidential data. With no link to the global matrix, the data was immune to every kind of attack via cyberspace. The catch, of course, was that you couldn't access it via the matrix. It was dead storage. He could have anything in there, Gentry said, pausing to look down at the unconscious face. He spun on his heel and began his pacing again.
A world. Worlds. Any number of personality constructs.
Like he's living a stim? Cherry asked. That why he's always in REM?
No, Gentry said. It's not simstim. It's completely interactive. And it's a matter of scale. If this is Aleph class Biosoft, he literally could have anything at all in there. In a sense, he could have an approximation of everything.
I got a feeling off Kid Africa, Cherry said, that this guy was paying to stay this way. Kinda Wirehead action, but different. And anyway, Wireheads don't REM like that.
But when you tried to put it out through your stuff, Slick ventured, you got that thing.
He saw Gentry's shoulders tense beneath black beaded leather.
Yes, Gentry said. And now I have to reconstruct our account with the Fission Authority.
He pointed at the permanent storage battery stacked beneath the steel table.
Get those out for me.
Yeah, Cherry said. It's about time. I'm freezing my ass.
They left Gentry bent over a cyberspace deck and went back to Slick's room. Cherry had insisted they rig Gentry's electric blanket to one of the batteries so she could drape it over the stretcher. There was cold coffee left on the butane stove. Slick drank it without bothering to reheat it, while Cherry stared out the window at the snow-streaked plain of the Solitude.
How'd it get like this? She asked.
Gentry says it was a landfill operation 100 years ago. Then they laid down a lot of topsoil, but stuff wouldn't grow. A lot of the fill was toxic. Rain washed the cover off. Guess they just gave up and started dumping more shit on it. Can't drink the water out there, full of PCBs and everything else.
What about those rabbits Bird Boy goes hunting for?
They're west of here. Don't see them on the Solitude. Not even rats. Anyway, you gotta test any meat you take around here.
There's birds, though.
Just roost here. Go somewhere else to feed.
What is it with you and Gentry?
She was still looking out the window.
How do you mean?
My first idea was maybe you were gay. Together, I mean.
No.
But it's kinda like you need each other some way.
It's his place, Factory. Lets me live here. I need to live here. To do my work.
To build those things downstairs?
The bulb in the yellow cone of fax came on. The fan in the heater kicked in.
Well,
Cherry said, squatting in front of the heater and unzipping one jacket after another.
He may be crazy, but he just did something right.
Gentry was slouched in the old office chair when Slick entered the loft, staring at the little flip-up monitor on his desk.
Robert Newmark, Gentry said.
Huh?
Retinal identification. Either this is Robert Newmark or someone who bought his eyes.
How'd you get that?
Slick bent to peer at the screen of basic birth stats. Gentry ignored the question.
This is it. Push it, and you run into something else entirely.
How's that?
Someone wants to know if anyone asks any questions about Mr. Newmark.
Who?
I don't know.
Gentry drummed his fingers on his black leather thighs.
Look at this. Nothing. Born in Barrytown. Mother, Marcia Newmark. We've got his sin, but it's definitely been tagged.
He shoved the chair back on its casters and swung around so that he could see the Count's still face.
How about it, Newmark? Is that your name?
He stood up and went to the hollow table.
Don't,
Slick said. Gentry touched the power stud on the hollow table. And the gray thing was there again for an instant, but this time it dived toward the core of the hemispherical display, dwindled, and was gone.
No, it was there, a minute gray sphere at the very center of the glowing projection field.
Gentry's crazy smile had returned.
Good, he said.
What's good?
I see what it is. A kind of ice. A security program.
That monkey?
Someone has a sense of humor. If the monkey doesn't scare you off, it turns into a pea.
He crossed to the table and began to root through one of his panniers.
I doubt if they'll be able to do that with a direct sensory link.
He held something in his hand now. A trodnet.
Gentry, don't do it. Look at him!
I'm not going to do it, Gentry said. You are.
Chapter 22. Ghosts and Empties. Staring through the cab's smudged windows, she found herself wishing for Colin and his wry commentary, then remembered that this was entirely beyond his sphere of expertise. Did Moss Neotech manufacture a similar unit for the sprawl, she wondered, and if so, what form would its ghost take?
Sally,
she said, perhaps half an hour into the drive to New York.
Why did Pato let me go with you?
Because he was smart.
And my father?
Your father'll shit.
I'm sorry?
We'll be angry, if he finds out. And he may not. We aren't here for long.
Why are we here?
I gotta talk to somebody.
But why am I here?
You don't like it here? Kumiko hesitated.
Yes, I do.
Good. Sally shifted on the broken-down seat. Petal had to let us go. Because he couldn't have stopped us without hurting one of us. Well, maybe not hurting, more like insulting. Swain could cool you, then tell you he was sorry later, tell your father was for your own good, if it came to that. But if he cools me, it's like face, right? When I saw Petal down there with the gun, I knew he was going to let us go. Your room's kinked, the whole place is. I set the motion sensors off when I was getting your gear together. Figured I would. Petal knew it was me. That's why he rang the phone, to let me know he knew.
I don't understand.
Kind of a courtesy? So I'd know he was waiting. Give me a chance to think. But he didn't have a choice, and he knew it. Swain, see, he's being forced to do something, and Petal knows it. Or anyway, Swain says he is being forced. Me, I'm definitely being forced. So I start wondering how bad Swain needs me. Real bad. Because they let me walk off with the Oyabun's daughter, shipped all the way to Notting Hill for the safekeeping. Something there scares him worse than your daddy. Less it's something that'll make him richer than your daddy already has.
Anyway, taking you kind of evens things up. Kind of like pushing back. You mind? But you are being threatened.
Somebody knows a lot of things I did.
And Tuka has discovered the identity of this person.
Yeah. I guess I knew anyway. Wish to fuck I'd been wrong. The hotel Sally chose was faced with rust-stained steel panels, each panel secured with gleaming chrome bolts, a style Kumiko knew from Tokyo and thought of as somewhat old-fashioned. Their room was large and gray, a dozen shades of gray, and Sally walked straight to the bed after she'd locked the door, took off her jacket, and lay down.
You don't have a bag, Kumiko said.
Sally sat up and began to remove her boots.
I can buy what I need.
You tired?
No.
I am.
She pulled her black sweater over her head. Her breasts were small, with brownish-pink nipples. A scar, running from just below the left nipple, vanished into the waistband of her jeans.
You were hurt,
Kumiko said, looking at the scar. Sally looked down.
Yeah. Why didn't you have it removed?
Sometimes it's good to remember.
Being hurt?
Being stupid. Gray on gray. Unable to sleep, Kumiko paced the gray carpet. There was something vampiric about the room, she decided. Something it would have in common with millions of similar rooms, as though its bewilderingly seamless anonymity were sucking away her personality, fragments of which emerged as her parents' voices raised an argument, as the faces of her father's black-suited secretaries. Sally slept, her face a smooth mask. The view from the window told Kumiko nothing at all, only that she looked out on a city that was neither Tokyo nor London. A vast generic tumble that was her century's paradigm of urban reality. Perhaps she slept too, Kumiko, though later she wasn't certain. She watched Sally order toiletries and underwear, tapping her requirements into the bedside video. Her purchases were delivered while Kumiko was in the shower.
Okay, Sally said from beyond the door. Towel off, get dressed. We're going to see the man.
What man?
Kumiko asked. But Sally hadn't heard her.
Gomi.
35% of the landmass of Tokyo was built on Gomi, on level tracts reclaimed from the bay through a century's systematic dumping. Gomi there was a resource to be managed, to be collected, sorted, carefully plowed under. London's relationship to Gomi was more subtle, more oblique. To Kumiko's eyes, the bulk of the city consisted of Gomi, of structures the Japanese economy would long ago have devoured in its relentless hunger for space in which to build. Yet, these structures revealed, even to Kumiko, the fabric of time. Each wall patched by generations of hands in an ongoing task of restoration. The English valued their Gomi in its own right, in a way she had only begun to understand. They inhabited it. Gomi in the sprawl was something else. A rich humus. A decay that sprouted prodigies in steel and polymer. The apparent lack of planning alone was enough to dizzy her, running so entirely opposite the value her own culture placed on efficient land use. Their taxi ride from the airport had already shown her decay. Whole blocks in ruin, unglazed windows gaping above sidewalks heaped with trash. And faces staring as the armored hover made its way through the streets. Now Sally plunged her abruptly into the full strangeness of this place, with its rot and randomness, rooting towers taller than any in Tokyo, corporate obelisks that pierced the sooty lacework of overlapping domes. Two cab rides away from their hotel, they took to the street itself, into early evening crowds in a slant of shadow. The air was cold, but not the cold of London, and Kumiko thought of the blossoms in Ueno Park. Their first stop was a large, somewhat faded bar called The Gentleman Loser, where Sally conducted a quiet, very rapid exchange with a bartender. They left without buying a drink.
Ghosts, Sally said, rounding a corner, Kumiko close at her side.
The streets had grown progressively more empty these past several blocks, the buildings darker and more decrepit.
Pardon me? A lot of ghosts here for me, or any way there should be. You know this place?
Sure.
Looks all the same but different, you know?
No.
Someday you will.
We find who I'm looking for. You just do your good girl routine. Speak if you're spoken to. Otherwise, don't.
Who are we looking for?
The man. What's left of him anyway? Half a block on, the grim street empty, Kumiko had never seen an empty street before, aside from Swain's Crescent, shrouded in midnight snow. Sally came to a halt beside an ancient and utterly unpromising storefront, its twin display window silvered with a rich inner coating of dust. Peering in, Kumiko made out the glass tube letters of an unlit neon sign. Metro. Then a longer word. The door between the windows had been reinforced with a sheet of corrugated steel. Rusting eye bolts protruded at intervals, strung with slack lengths of galvanized razor wire. Now Sally faced that door, squared her shoulders, and executed a fluid series of small, quick gestures. Kumiko stared as the sequence was repeated.
Sally?
Jive! Sally cut her off. I told you to shut up, okay? Yeah. The voice, barely more than a whisper, seemed to come from nowhere in particular.
I told you already,
Sally said. I don't jive. I want to talk to him, she said, her voice hard and careful. He's dead. I know that. A silence followed, and Kumiko heard a sound that might have been the wind, a cold, grit-laden wind, scouring the curve of the geodesics far above them. He's not here, the voice said, and seemed to recede.
Round the corner, half a block, left into the alley.
Kumiko would remember the alley always. Dark brick, slick with damp, hooded ventilators, trailing black streamers of congealed dust. A yellow bulb in a cage of corroded alloy. The low growth of empty bottles that sprouted at the base of either wall. The man-sized nests of crumpled facts and white foam packing segments, and the sound of Sally's boot heels. Past the bulb's dim glow was darkness, though a reflected gleam on wet brick showed a final wall, cul-de-sac, and Kumiko hesitated, frightened by a sudden stir of echo, a scurrying, the steady dripping of water. Sally raised her hand. A tight beam of very bright light framed a sharp circle of paint-scrawled brick, then smoothly descended. Descended until it found the thing at the base of the wall. Dull metal. An upright, rounded fixture that Kumiko mistook for another ventilator. Near its base were the stubs of white candles, a flat plastic flask filled with a clear liquid, an assortment of cigarette packets, a scattering of loose cigarettes, and an elaborate, multi-armed figure drawn in what appeared to be white powdered chalk. Sally stepped forward. The beam held steady, and Kumiko saw that the armored thing was bolted into the brickwork with massive rivets.
Finn.
A rapid flicker of pink light from a horizontal slot.
Hey, Finn. Man.
An uncharacteristic hesitation in her voice.
Maul.
A grating quality, as if through a broken speaker.
What's with the flash? You still got amps in? Getting old, you can't see in the dark so good?
For my friend. Something moved behind the slot. Its color, the unhealthy pink of hot cigarette ash in noon sunlight. And Kumiko's face was washed with a stutter of light.
Yeah,
grated the voice.
So? Who's she?
Yanaka's daughter.
No shit.
Sally lowered the light. It fell on the candles, the flask, the damp gray cigarettes, the white symbol with its feathery arms.
Help yourself to the offerings,
said the voice.
That's half a liter of Moskovskaya there. The hoodoo marks flower.
Tough luck. The high rollers draw them in cocaine.
Jesus. Sally said, an odd distance in her voice, squatting down. I don't believe this. Kumiko watched as she picked up the flask and sniffed at the contents.
Drink it. It's good shit. Fucking better be. Nobody short counts the Oracle. Not if they know what's good for him.
Finn, Sally said, then tilted the flask and swallowed, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. You gotta be crazy.
I should be so lucky. A rig like this? I'm pushing it to have a little imagination, let alone crazy.
Kumiko moved closer, then squatted beside Sally. It's a construct? A personality job? Sally put down the flask of vodka and stirred the damp flour with the tip of a white fingernail.
Sure. You seen him before? Real-time memory if I wanna, wired into C-space if I wanna. Got this Oracle gig to keep my hand in, you know.
The thing made a strange sound. Laughter.
Got love troubles? Got a bad woman don't understand you?
The laugh noise again, like peals of static.
Actually, I'm more into business advice. It's the local kids leave the goodies. Adds to the mystique, kinda. And once in a while, I get a skeptic. Some asshole figures who'll help himself to the take.
A scarlet hairline flashed from the slit, and a bottle exploded somewhere to Kumiko's right. Static laughter.
So what brings you this way, Maul? You and...
Again the pink light flicked across Kumiko's face.
Yanaka's daughter.
The stray light run. Sally said.
Long time, Maul.
She's after me, Finn. 14 years, and that crazy bitch is on my ass.
So maybe she's got nothing better to do. You know how rich folks are.
You know where Case is, Finn? Maybe she's after him.
Case got out of it. Rolled up a few good scores after you split. Then he kicked it in the head and quit clean. You did the same, maybe you wouldn't be freezing your buns off in an alley, right?
Last I heard, he had 4 kids. Watching the hypnotic sweep of the scanning pink ember, Kumiko had some idea of what it was that Sally spoke with. There were similar things in her father's study, 4 of them, black lacquered cubes arranged along a low shelf of pine. Above each cube hung a formal portrait. The portraits were monochrome photographs of men in dark suits and ties. 4 very sober gentlemen whose lapels were decorated with small metal emblems of the kind her father sometimes wore. Though her mother had told her that the cubes contained ghosts, the ghosts of her father's evil ancestors, Kumiko found them more fascinating than frightening. If they did contain ghosts, she reasoned, they would be quite small, as the cubes themselves were scarcely large enough to contain a child's head. Her father sometimes meditated before the cubes, kneeling on the bare tatami in an attitude that connoted profound respect. She had seen him in this position many times, but she was 10 before she heard him address the cubes, and one had answered. The question had meant nothing to her, the answer less, but
The calm tone of the ghost's reply had frozen her where she crouched behind a door of paper, and her father had laughed to find her there. Rather than scolding her, he'd explained that the cubes housed the recorded personalities of former executives, corporate directors. "Their souls?" she'd asked. "No," he'd said, and smiled. Then added that the distinction was a subtle one. "They are not conscious. They respond when questioned in a manner approximating the response of the subject. If they are ghosts, then holograms are ghosts." After Sally's lecture on the history and hierarchy of the Yakuza in the Robata Bar in Earl's Court, Kumiko had decided that each of the men in the photographs, the subjects of the personality recordings, had been an Oyabun. The thing in the armored housing, she reasoned, was of a similar nature, though perhaps more complex. Just as Colin was a more complex version of the Michelin guide her father's secretaries had carried on her Shinjuku shopping expeditions. Finn, Sally called it, and it was evident that this Finn had been a friend or associate of hers. But did it wake, Kumiko wondered, when the alley was empty? Did its laser vision scan the silent fall of midnight snow?
"Europe," Sally began. "When I split from Case, I went all around there. Had a lot of money we got for the run. Anyway, it looked like a lot then. Tessier Ashpool's AI paid it out through a Swiss bank. It erased every trace we'd ever been up the well. I mean, everything. Like if you looked up the names we traveled under on the JAL shuttle, they just weren't there. Case checked it all out when we were back in Tokyo. Wormed his way into all kinds of data. It was like none of it ever happened. I didn't understand how it could do that, AI or not, but nobody ever really understood what happened up there. When Case rode the Chinese icebreaker through their core ice.
Did it try to get in touch after?
Not that I know of. He had this idea that it was gone, sort of. Not gone, gone, but gone into everything. The whole matrix. Like it wasn't in cyberspace anymore. It just was. And if it didn't want you to see it, to know it was there, well, there was no way you ever could. And no way you'd ever be able to prove it to anybody else, even if you did know. And me, I didn't want to know. I mean, whatever it was, it seemed done to me. Finished. Armitage was dead, Riviera was dead, Ashpool was dead. The Rostatuck pilot who took us out there was back in Zion Cluster, and he'd probably written it all off as another ganja dream. I left Case in the Tokyo Hyatt. Never saw him again.
Why?
Who knows? Nothing much. I was young. It just seemed over.
But you'd left her up the well. In stray light.
You got it. And I'd think about that once in a while. When we were leaving Finn, it was like she didn't care about any of it. Like I'd killed her crazy sick father for her, and Case had cracked their cores and let their AIs loose in the Matrix. So I put her on the list, right? You get big enough trouble one day, you're being got at, you check that list.
And you figured it for her right off?
No.
I got a pretty long list.
Case, who seemed to Kumiko to have been something more than Sally's partner, never re-entered her story. As Kumiko listened to Sally condense 14 years of personal history for the Finn's benefit,
She found herself imagining this younger Sally as a Bishonen hero in a traditional romantic video. Faye.